We have some from our regular number that are missing for various reasons, but we have several that are visiting as well. So that helps to balance that out. We really appreciate you taking the time and effort to share our day together with you, worshiping God. It is my sincere hope and prayer that our study of the Word together this morning will stir your minds and help us all to draw closer to God. A lot of you here know that recently I buried a friend, and that really put me to thinking about some things. You know how it is in life when you face a tragedy that's close to home, it makes you look inside and take inventory. And I've been spending a lot of time doing that lately. Makes you ask a lot of questions about yourself. Do I really believe this? And I do. Will my anchor hold in this storm of life? I believe that it will. We just sang about that. And that song we just sang is packed with inferences back to Scripture that talks to us about how to hold on through life storms. As I reflected on this more and more, I was compelled to bring some of my questions and comments to a co-worker in Christ. I visited with Brother Sean Zeebach about some of the things that I was thinking. And one of the things I was thinking regarding the brevity and frailty of life and the certainty of death was, you know, I'm 47. My friend that died was 52. How much time do I have left? Well, I know that's a morbid question. We're not supposed to talk about that. We'll buckle down because we're going to. Am I going to live a typical number of years, 70, 80? That's pretty close to average for United States today. I said, you know, Sean, if you and I live to be that age, how many more friends are we going to bury? How much more family do we have to lower down into the ground? How many more times are we going to face a crisis like this that really backs you against the wall and makes you stop and think and has you feeling low for days on end? You know, Sean always has the right words. He stuck his finger in my face and said, "Preach it." And I said, "Yes, sir." So I went home with this passage on my mind. The passage I had on my mind is on that first slide. There we go. Psalms chapter 90, verse 12. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts into wisdom. This is from a song that speaks often about the fragility of life and the certainty of death, the frailty of human life, our weakness. And this song cries out and requests to God, teach us to number our days. Well, how many days do I have left? That's what I was asking the other day. The fact of the business is, I don't know. Sometimes the end of life catches us by surprise. Very often, in fact, in my friend's case, it was not expected, it was a total shock, and it just all at once, and there it was. And so we're compelled to ask, teach me to remember, to realize the fragility of life, to really know and really believe that death is real and that it's coming. There are many passages that speak to us about the brevity of life and the frailty of life. Psalms 39, verse 4 and 5 joins a rather lengthy chorus along these lines when he said, Lord, make me to know my end, that the measure of my days, what it is, that I may know how frail I am. Behold, thou hast made my days as a handbreadth, and mine age is as nothing before thee. Verily, every man at his best state is altogether vanity. Do I really believe that? You know what? If I don't believe that, that doesn't change whether or not it's true. It just changes whether or not I have a state of readiness in my mind for what's coming. This passage talks about the fact that our life is frail. It takes so little to end what seems like so much. I mean, aren't there days you feel so alive and so powerful and so everything's going just right and so it seems like this could go on indefinitely? And then you wake up one day and realize one bad artery, one misplaced bullet, one jerk of the steering wheel, one small accident, one small on purpose, one small whatever. And we who seem so, who feel so bulletproof and indestructible are exposed for what we really are. So very frail. I feel like I've lived a long time already, and if I live an ordinary lifespan, I know that feeling will increase as time goes by. Some things that didn't happen all that long ago seem like they were forever ago. And so while in the midst of our strivings here below, it feels like that life is so long. But this song from God here in Psalms chapter 39 forces us to realize it's just a handbreadth. My hand's not very big, but that's not very long. Maybe your hand's bigger. In the greater scheme of humankind, our life is just a speck. It's just a handbreadth. And in our best state, at the most we can do, the most we can live, the most we can extract out of this life on earth, at the end of the day, it's still just a vapor in the breeze. It's vanity. It's something that's there one moment and then in the next moment it's gone. And so James 4 and 14 aptly reminds us, whereas we know not what shall be on the morrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. Just what we learn from Psalms 39 is loudly confirmed with these resounding words that speak amen to the psalmist's message. It's coming. Life really is a vapor. And it's not just about this thought occurring to me so I can sit here and hang my head for a few days and then forget about it. That's one thing I wondered about as I was driving home from the funeral. I wondered, well, what's going to happen? Am I going to feel this way for another day or two? And then a few days down the road, I'm going to somehow let myself forget that life is frail and all too brief? Is this feeling that has spiritually awakened me to the need to stay ready, is that feeling going to fade? Am I to just sink back into blind oblivion and somehow convince myself that somehow that person in that box will never be me? I've got tomorrow, don't I? I bet you do too. So whatever it is that I need to get done before God today, I'm not going to worry about it. I'll just take care of it tomorrow. And when tomorrow gets here, trust me, I'll have another excuse on the ready. And I'll convince myself that I've got just at least one more day. Oh, I know death's coming someday, but not today and surely not tomorrow. And this passage stares me back in the face and says, Dave, you don't know what's on tomorrow. You don't know what's coming next. In Psalms chapter 90, verse 9 and 10, all our days have passed away in your wrath. We finish our years like a sigh. The days of our lives are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they are 80 years, yet their boast is only labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off and we fly away. The most of which our days can boast is labor and sorrow. Oh, but I'm having fun. I know you are. I am too. I'm enjoying a lot of things in life. And I know you're enjoying a lot of things in life. And a lot of the things that we enjoy in life are blessings from God and designed for our enjoyment. They're designed to give us a sense of contentment and fulfillment as we pass our lives here. And yet, there's some sense of vanity to it all. There's some sense of waking up and realizing, no matter how much fun I have, no matter how much joy I can glean from what pleasure I can find, godly or not, someday I'll finish my years with a sigh. Then what will I have? Someday death will catch me, whether expectedly or unexpectedly. And then what will there be that these hands can hold on to and find pleasure in? Naught but eternity. And will I be prepared? Maybe it feels like an unpleasant thing to discuss. These thoughts have been most unpleasant in my mind. And maybe they feel that way to you as you savor them. But be assured that the Scriptures teach us that sometimes it's good for us to go to this place that we've journeyed together today. The Bible teaches in Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 2, it is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to heart. I would rather go where there is a festive and robust celebration than to go to that funeral and face that reminder that says, David, your days are numbered. But deep down, I know which one does me the best. Deep down, I know which one stirs in me the deepest, most meaningful, most needed changes. And you do too. Sorrow in life, such as we sometimes face, forces us to realize that whatever joys we find in these years diminish in those times of overwhelming sorrow and ultimately pass into nothing in the hour of our own death. This passage reminds us that we're better off to face that time of grief and as a living person while we're still alive and we still have that hope as the anchor of our soul to hold on to that. And take it to heart. Take to heart the lesson that says, my life is frail. My life is brief. It is just a handbreadth before God. And my days will end with a sigh that heaves out the frustrations of a long life of labor and sorrow. It is good for us to go to this house of mourning. We find in Scripture different individuals who had a time in their life where they were trapped in sorrow with problems. One such individual was King David. We'll read about him in just a moment here in 1 Samuel chapter 20 in verse 3. What it is that wakes us up to the reality of life's brevity and life's frailty is the sorrowful times that we have to face. And they may be relatively short in between a lot of times of splendor, but they're still there and they're still powerful. David was going through a very difficult time in his life. He was a rather young man, but his family life had fallen apart. His father-in-law, his friend, and his king had turned against him. I'm talking about King Saul. And King Saul greedily and angrily sought David's life. I can't imagine a relationship between a father-in-law and a son-in-law deteriorating to such a depth. And I can't imagine to what depths of lower feeling that caused David to sink. He could not go and be with his wife's family. He could not go and be with his king and his father-in-law. He could not go and be with his treasured friend and brother-in-law, Jonathan. He couldn't go be with his own blood kin, because if he went anywhere where they might know that he was there, Saul's forces would catch him and kill him. And so his once wonderful life, filled with a rapid succession of joy upon joy, all blessings from God meant for David's pleasure, had been reduced to and relegated to him cowering and hiding in the wilderness, wishing that his wife's family loved him. Thus we find David suffering in 1 Samuel 20 and verse 3. And here he says to Jonathan, David sware him over and said, "Thy father certainly knoweth that I have found grace in thine eyes." And he saith, "Let not Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly as the Lord liveth and as thy soul liveth, there is but a step between me and death." What would you say to David? I mean, he has a reason to be sad. He has a reason to grieve. His father-in-law doesn't just dislike him. He wants him dead. And he craves that. With what words would you comfort such a one? "Oh, it's okay, David. It's going to be all right." Oh, really? What's all right about a life so void of love from your family? That's going to be all right? No, it's going to be sad. And it's wrong. It's not godly for this to go on. And if something ungodly is going on, that's not okay. Well, what will we tell David? "It's okay, David. You're not as close to death as you think you are." Well, he lived a few more years than he might have anticipated at that moment in time. But at the end of the day, David's life was still short. It was still just a handbreadth. It still ended in sighing. His life was still a vapor. And his time on earth was long, long past. So what he realized was true. But what did it take to make him stare that realization squarely in the face? The things which he suffered. The sorrows that were his to own, all alone in the wilderness, forced David to have this awakened mindset that says, "I am one step from death." And I want to tell you, the same is true for this David that stands before you today and for everyone who listens. One step from death. Job suffered a lot of things in his life. If you're remotely familiar even with the book, you know that Job lost his children. He lost all his possessions. He had a loss of health. Great sorrows came upon him. Up until that time, he had a life filled with joyful things, what we would call a good life. Good family, a lot of wealth, plenty of opportunities to help others. He was well known in the community and well respected. But sorrow brought him to this brink. "My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and are spent without hope." I remember one time in the village parlor in India, the communist police officers were holding us up and not wanting to let us leave town just yet. And so while some of our brothers from India went and dealt with that issue, we just sat out on some random porch in the village, where they were collecting goat hair that had been sheared and putting it in a pile, and then they had somebody over there with the spindle working that into thread, and somebody else had the weaver shuttle, a hand-operated weaver shuttle, putting together blankets made from the goat wool. And so, to pass the time while issues were being dealt with, we just watched them work. And when that person hit the weaver shuttle, you know, I can't describe to you how that's all tied up and how it works, but imagine this complicated piece of wooden equipment where there's yarn tied to different ends, and they're slinging this long stick of wood this way and slinging another one back through that way and just back and forth and weaving this way and that, and zing, zing, zoom, zoom. It's just fast, fast, fast. It happens so fast we could scarcely see the motion with our eyes. It actually was more a blur than a clear picture. Now, Job in his ancient day didn't have fast things like cars and jet planes and high-speed trains, so he had to compare speed to things that were fast in his day. And in his day, that weaver shuttle was fast. In the peak of Job's joyfulness, was he thinking this? Oh, I know he was living a righteous life, but was this thought on the tip of his mind? Or did facing sorrow and tragedy and loss in life remind him? Did going to the house of mourning teach him so that he as a living man could lay it to heart that, you know, our days really are swift as the weaver's shuttle? And here comes the part that hurts. They're spent without hope. Did Job have hope as an anchor for his soul? Well, it was available. And sometimes in the book that bears his name, we find him speaking of this hope. But on many occasions, he allowed his sorrows to swallow him up. And he spoke words such as this. Not really accurate words. That feeling we can all have all too easily. That there really is no hope. But there really is hope. Job, in the very next verse, said, "Oh, remember that my life is wind. My eye shall see no more good." I'm sorry to remind you of our weather's constant vexation of us this year, but we've had a lot of wind. And I don't know about your house, but most of the wind we've had in New Deal has been really fast. We sometimes talk about trying to catch the wind. Maybe you've heard that expression in song or poem. You can't catch it. It's fleeting. It's so quickly gone. It can't be grasped. Thus, Job describes the brevity of life. A life in which he sees no more good because he's so down due to his suffering. In Job 9 and 25, he said, "Now my days are swifter than a post. They flee away. They see no good." We imagine the ancient post passing in some manner similar to our more recent Pony Express, where horses would carry things from one town or one village to the next, and they would swap out for fresh horses and keep going and carry these important messages from place to place. And Job, in his slower day, sees that as something that's amazingly swift. Then in a matter of days, a journey of hundreds of miles could be made. Thus Job perceived his life, swiftly passing before his eyes. Job 9 and 26, "There passed as the swift ships, as the eagle that hasteth to the prey." Over and over, Job grasped for things to compare the brevity of life to. Over and over, his sorrows, his affliction, the house of mourning in which it was his lot to dwell, pounded into his head. This is not going to last forever. All this fun that I've been having with my kids and my camels there and my goats and all these possessions and things that made us secure and made us feel like we were going to make it and we were going to survive and life is good and I can bounce a grandbaby on my knee and my wife loves me and the people of the city, they stand up when I walk through the gate and things are great, but it's not going to last forever. There's going to come a day that it will end with a sigh. And so Job is compelled to conclude that man that is born of woman is few days and full of trouble. He cometh forth like a flower and is cut down. He fleeth also as a shadow and continueth not. It hurts, but it's true. There's another man whose sorrows speak of the brevity of life. I'm thinking about Jacob. In the time in his life where he had come down to Egypt with the rest of his family and he was near the end of his days. You know, Jacob had a lot to look back on. Some of it was good, but some of it was hard to deal with. He had a twin brother he had competed with all their life together. And Jacob won the competition, so to speak. But I suspect there were times in his life it was hard to feel like the winner. Because Esau, and the threat against his life was so strong that he had to leave his homeland and his kinfolk. He couldn't see his mom and his dad again and his brother and all whatever other family there might have been that he might have enjoyed. He couldn't no longer have that. He had to go away, and as if that wasn't enough, when he went away, he got a job, and you're thinking, in times like this, that sounds like good news till you realize your boss is an old boy named Laban, who's as crooked as a dog's hind leg. And he'll cheat his own kinfolk and not blink an eye about it. He'll cheat his own son-in-law, and that's just how he treated Jacob. 10 times Jacob protested on one occasion, "You've changed my wages." When he parted ways with Laban, he all but said, "You're a crook. You've made my life miserable." And away he went. Well, I know things got better when he got back to Canaan until the famine hit. And you're a few years into a famine and you're looking around at your kids and your grandkids and the servants and the beasts of burden that you depend on. And it's on your shoulders whether or not they eat. And you see the drought, and you see the blowing dust, and you see the dead crops and the dried grass and the hopelessness of, are these people going to eat or not? Because whether or not they eat is my problem. That's the condition we find him in when his son Joseph brought him to Egypt where there was plenty. And Pharaoh calls him before him, and I picture this grizzled old man, this grizzled old shepherd, whom the scriptures tells us worshiped God leaning on his staff. Pharaoh asked him what we would all want to ask. How old are you? Since Jacob wasn't a woman, it was okay to ask that. Jacob said unto Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been. And have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my fathers and the days of their pilgrimage." Notice first Jacob's confession. My life is a pilgrimage. That means I'm going there, but I'm not going to go long. I'm coming right back. Life is short. He lived a long time. I don't expect to live 130 years. I'm not sure I want to. In our way of thinking, 130 years is a long life to live. But to Jacob, it was but a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. And the sorrows which he had suffered and the point to which he had sunk as age crept more swiftly upon him forced him to confess that his days were few and evil. He'd had a lot of problems. I know he'd had some good times, he'd had some joys, but those were sprinkled with difficulties that forced him to realize the brevity and the frailty of life. And I'm sorry, I know that sounds so hopeless. I know that does. And that's why all morning long I've been so anxious to get to this next passage. In Proverbs 14 and 32 he says, "The wicked is driven away in his wickedness, but the righteous hath hope in death." The first words that crossed my mind when I walked up to my friend's casket was, "There's hope." The first words we often whisper in the family's ear, "There's hope." This is not a meaningless collection of molecules that's just been rattling for the last 52 years and now they've stopped rattling, so let's all go on and rattle in our own direction. Life is not that meaningless. This is loss. This is pain. This hurts, but there's hope. Even though we're confronted with death, even though we're confronted with the house of mourning, even though our mood is low, even though we're in a hole, we wonder if we'll ever crawl out. There's hope for the righteous, even in death. And we have this hope as an anchor for our souls. And the point is this, what this all means is we're supposed to learn from this. We're supposed to learn from staring death in the face and realize that our lives mean something and the way we choose to live them means something. And when Job said our years are spent without hope, that's one part that he got wrong. They're spent, oh yes, and all too quickly, but not without hope. For the righteous, there is hope even in death. And that's why it matters how we live. That's why it matters that we learn this lesson that sorrow helps us learn if we'll just listen. while we're gathered at the house of mourning. And just lay it to heart. Someday that'll be me. And I don't know when it's coming. God, teach me to number my days. What it means is get right with God. King Hezekiah had a moment in his life where he was going to die. It eventually changed because he prayed that it would change, but here's where he was. In those days, Hezekiah was sick unto death, and the prophet Isaiah, the son of Amos, came to him and said to him, "Thus saith the Lord, set thy house in order, for thou shalt die and not live." What did he wind up having? Another 15 years? So let me ask you this question. Does that mean you wait 15 years before you set your house in order? That's not the message. The message is you don't know where you're at in life. Hezekiah thought he was right at the end of his way and about to draw his rations. Turned out God in his mercy gave him another 15 years. No doubt an act of mercy for the people of Judah, which Hezekiah faithfully led as well. But the message still remains. Your life is short. You got another 15 years. That's not a lot of time. I don't know about you, but my last 15 have been a whisper. It's happened fast. So what do we need to do? Wherever we're at in life, we need to take in this lesson that sorrow would help us to learn and get our house right. Get our family right. Take the time to do the things that you need to do to get right. And don't think that chance is sure to be there tomorrow. In John 9 and verse 4, Jesus talked about his own life when he said, "I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work." What Christ saw coming in his own life is something that fits us all. If we're to be a servant of God, then we must busy ourselves at God's work now while there's a chance to work, because there's going to come a moment in time where we have no more chance. You got somebody that you're supposed to love and be at peace and harmony with, then go sit down with them and make that happen. You have somebody that you've wronged and you need to go fix things, then you go sit down and make that happen now. You have a God whom you've offended and you've lived your life outside of Him and you need to be united with Him through His Son, then you go make that happen. Is there someone that needs a helping hand? Is there someone that craves a good deed? Is there a heart that's lonely that needs an arm around their shoulder? Is there someone that needs a prayer said on their behalf? If there's someone that needs loving correction to guide them as they walk their way, then you need to work now. You need to act now. Because the night of death is closing ever rapidly upon your own eyes. And then your last chance will be gone. We've got to get right and we've got to start now. As Ecclesiastes 12 and 1 says, "Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them." Wherever you're at, you start now. It's urgent. Remember your Creator. Even if you're in the youth of life, don't presume to think that you have forever. You don't. Life at its best is vain. And for you, who can guarantee that it won't be especially short? Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 4 gives us more reason to conclude that we must start now. He said, "For him that is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion." That's a proverb that fits so many situations in life. That statement, a living dog is better than a dead lion. Let's apply it to the brevity of life. As long as you are alive, there's hope that you can make up your mind to do the right thing and get right with God and stay right with God. As long as you're alive, there's that hope. Here sits this person living up the sumptuous years, watching them roll by, enjoying the pleasures of this life, refusing to accept that someday it will all come crashing down in death. Until one day death finds that rich farmer in Christ's story, and God says, "Now, who shall these things be that you have provided?" That man may have felt like a lion, bold as a lion while he was living, living it up, faring sumptuously every day. But that lion is weak in death. Some people would have us to believe that the life of a Christian is a dog's life. But with the living, there's hope, and a living dog is better than a dead lion. We've got to get right and we've got to stay right. Ephesians 5, 15 and 16 says, "See that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil." He says we've got to walk circumspectly. That means uprightly. Our spectrum, our vision has to be in a circle. We've got to walk looking all around us, you see. Seeing the good and the bad, seeing our duties before God, all these things. Like they say in sports, you play with your head on a swivel. You understand this. We've got to live our lives that way, always aware of what our duty before God is. And in doing that, we are redeeming the time. I've thought a lot about this, redeeming the time. Because it sounds like something we can't do. That word translated redeem means you're going and buying it back. And here's the thing about yesterday. I can't have it again. It's gone. I can't undo, I can't redo. This ain't a cheap game of golf. There are no mulligans. I've lived what I've lived and that's gone. So how can I go buy that back? It occurs to me that maybe I'm not buying back what's already spent. I'm living like I'm buying back what I'm about to spend. Does that make sense to you? I'm redeeming the time that's in front of me. Well, how much time is that? I don't know, but God teach me to number my days. And know they are but few. So that I can live my life with a constant, acute awareness that I need to always redeem the time by making good decisions out in front of me. I can't redo the bad ones behind me. I wished I could, but I can't. And I know you feel the same way. But we've got to press on with hope as the anchor for our souls. With that hope, we can have the strength to come through the sorrows and the troubles of this life. And when we reach that time of death that felt so hopeless earlier in our study, we can remember that in death for the righteous, there is yet hope. We've got to redeem the time. In 1 Peter 1 and verse 17, he put it like this. If you call on the Father who without respect of persons judges according to every man's work, pass the time of your sojourning here in fear. That sounds an awful lot like redeeming the time to me. We pass our time here with wisdom, with a healthy fear of God, with a realization we answer for how we've lived. Let us then live accordingly. There was a time under David's rule, King David, that Israel was at a tough time. It was one of those deals where, without going into a lot of detail, heads were going to roll. Things were getting rough. And a woman came before David to plead Israel's cause in a roundabout way. And in pleading the cause, she said something about life that's so elegant, so beautiful. I want to share that with you now. What she said, we find in 2 Samuel 14 and verse 14. She said to her king, "We must needs die, and are as water spilt on the ground, and cannot be gathered up again." She rightly observed that as we pass the days here, we are spilling water on the sand, and we can't get it back. And once life comes to an end and that water is all poured out, it's gone. Time is gone. Our days are done. We can't retrieve them. We can't redo them. That good deed you could have done, should have done, you can't get it back. That decision to obey the gospel that you could have made years ago, and given the Lord all these years since then of good service, you can't get that back. That decision to come back to Christ that you could have made yesterday, a week ago, a month ago, 5 years ago, all that time you wasted that you could have been serving the Lord. It's water spilt on the sand. You can't get it back. The person you should have helped, the person you should have prayed for, the person you should have loved, the person you should have made peace with, the people you should have spent time with, the good things we all should have been doing. We can't get it back. Once it's gone, time is gone. There's no retrieving it. We'd better redeem the time now while we have a chance. Lord, teach us to number our days and to live our days clinging to this hope as the anchor of our soul. If you don't have that hope as the anchor of your soul right now, we want to offer it to you through the power of Jesus Christ. We want to give you this opportunity to obey the gospel if you've never done so. Or if you're a Christian and you need the prayers of the church to assist you in your walk with the Lord, we would love to offer you those prayers at this time. If we can help you in either way, please come. Have a seat on the front pew while we stand and sing.